America, and to all of our listeners all over the world, you're listening to yet another exciting edition of Let's Weekend. I'm your host with most Brandon Perkins. Joining me, as always, is Chris Logie. Say hi to the good people, Chris.
Hello.
Yeah, so this episode is going to be for May 20th, 2023. We are fast approaching into summer, and I want to say it's starting to feel like it, but not quite. We've been getting a lot of rain these last few days, so it's actually remained relatively, you know, by southern summer standards, it's been relatively cool in that it's mostly been in the 70s and low 80s. But, you know, every so often, you know, it'll peek its head out and remind you, hey, you live in a sun-drenched hellscape. Enjoy it. But, yeah, so anyway, this week, what do we got? Well, among other things, we basically got, you know, politicians behaving badly and doing awful shit. Which, you know, what else is new? The election in Turkey is heading into a runoff, and we're going to tell you why that's significant. Especially considering who's currently the head of state there and what he might do if he loses. Also, you know that whole thing about how you basically have to go through like a bunch of third parties in a lot of states if you're trying to file your taxes because, you know, the tax code is like needlessly convoluted and complex? Well, the IRS is actually trying to make an alternative to that, and it's kind of making a lot of those tax software companies really pissed off. And we'll tell you why. Also, the ongoing feud between the Walt Disney Corporation and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is once again rearing its ugly head, and it just cost the state $1 billion in potential jobs and losses. And, of course, we've got a couple of organized labor-related stories, including for one thing, SAG-AFTRA is getting ready to call another strike authorization, which is, as we'll explain, is fairly typical when it comes to studio negotiations like this. It's not unheard of, but it is interesting considering the sort of context that's involved this time, especially considering certain other union in the entertainment industry that's still on strike, last I checked. And of course we got a bunch of entertainment related stuff, including some trailers and teasers to talk of. But of course, it's not just that. We got a bunch of other stuff to talk about, all that and more on this week's episode of Let's Weekend. But as usual, let's start off as is tradition, talking about all the things we've been doing up to this week, up until this moment we decided to record the show. And as usual, we'll start with you, Chris. Chris, what have you been doing this week?
Dealing with stuff around here. Weather's been all right, so it rained this morning to cool it down a little bit, but not that much. It's been mostly in like the 60s to mid 70s for the week, so it's not been too bad for us. But yeah, been watching some stuff. Went and watched Fast X in the local theater yesterday, which was pretty good. You can definitely tell that this is, I think it was supposed to be a two-part sort of finale for the series, but I think they just recently announced it's going to be three parts instead. And you can definitely tell that they are stretching things out, because there's lots of, oh, here's this person in a precarious situation where they could, you know, die, all that kind of stuff. And yeah, they do lots of cameos, even cameos I didn't get because I haven't seen all of the movies. I've seen about half of them, including the last handful here, but they definitely reference other things that I didn't get until I saw an article sort of about some of those cameos. That kind of stuff, and even have like a post-credit stinger. They're like, oh yeah, and here's this person that'll be around next time. It's like, okay, I guess, sure. Yeah, Jason Momoa is a great villain. He's very much playing a Joker-style villain, who is very much, you know, psychotic and just causing chaos because he can. With the tools that he has at his disposal, all that kind of stuff. So that's makes for a very fun kind of a performance there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely one to check out.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of ridiculous stunts and all that kind of stuff. The other one I watched, this just appeared on Disney Plus, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of the kickoff of this Kang the Conqueror arc in the MCU. And this definitely does some interesting stuff. But yeah, it's kind of all over the place a bit as Scott and the family are all pulled into the quantum realm.
Mm-hmm.
As they realize, like, oh, there's a lot more going on here than we thought and we're told. Mm-hmm. And they go to find out, you know, oh, this guy named the Conqueror is sort of trapped here, and he's trying to find a way out, potentially one that he had at one point that got pulled away mm-hmm. or taken from him. So that leaves a whole bunch of time to do a bunch of weird stuff as they deal with the sort of mechanics of the Ant-Man shrinking and growing kind of thing in the quantum realm,
mm-hmm.
And dealing with the societies that have formed in the quantum realm and all that stuff. It's pretty fun, but much like the other Ant-Man movies, it's not like an amazing movie or anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, pretty solid movie.
Mm.
But they do have some good cameos and such with the one of the most notable people from I Think You Should Leave, the old guy in the car survey ad, skit. You know, the guy's like, oh, I want a car with the weird steering wheel that won't fly off. You know, that kind of guy. He shows up a couple times selling coffee to the Scott and calls him Spider-Man the one time. Then next time he's like, oh no, I had the wrong bug. You're the bug that gets bigger and then smaller, that kind of thing. So yeah, there's some fun bits in there. And I forget what's his name from The Good Place. Chidi.
Mm-hmm.
He shows up as a fairly notable character, at least for this movie.
Mm-hmm.
That was a bit of a surprise. So yeah. There's some fun stuff there, but that's been pretty much it for things I've been watching. Been playing more Tears of the Kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of mostly trying to unlock all the towers and kind of open that stuff up.
Yeah.
Especially being able to fast travel around the map more easily. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I did a stream earlier trying to play some more of that and doing some of the quests in the Zora Kingdom. The one thing I do have kind of an issue with is just the quest rewards are not all that particularly good.
It kind of depends.
Yeah.
I do remember that being kind of an issue with Breath of the Wild with some of them, because some of them would be like, you know, you do a lot and it ends up just kind of being like, I did all this for just this. Yeah, it's feels kind of like I got kind of ripped off, but
yeah. So the thing is, like, rupees are really hard to come by.
Oh god,
I feel like that would be a better quest reward where I get surprised now when I've run into a couple. It's like, oh, you gave me this. I'll give you 100 rupees. I'm like, holy shit, that's like 50% of what I had going into that
mm-hmm.
kind of thing. So. And I just spent all of it on a mediocre outfit that's in the landing area.
Yeah.
Where, you know, initially Pearl's like, oh, yeah, there's a shop over there. You can buy an outfit. I'm like, with what money? Link at this point has 0 rupees to his name. And I feel like people should be like, here, stop being half naked and here's an outfit for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, going to particularly provide any sort of great defense or anything, but this will keep you from being, you know, like a weird half naked Kratos looking weirdo. But yeah, still enjoying that a lot. The other game I've been putting some time into is just Rocket League, as I usually do.
Mm-hmm.
They got a Fast and Furious event of sorts. It's not really any sort of gameplay stuff. They're putting all the previous Fast and Furious cars into the game for people to buy if they missed it around the first time. But they're also adding a couple more that's come from this movie, and I think the last one, Fast 9, that one's fun because that is a it's the rocket car that they tape up all the doors to, you know, quote unquote seal it and send it into space. That's a car they have in here, and that's a fun one. So, but that's been pretty much it for me. So how about you, Brandon?
Well, just like you, I'm still basically almost entirely focused on Tears of the Kingdom, especially since I actually got it Monday, so I've actually been able to play it. But yeah, goddamn, this game is good. I will admit it did kind of take me a little bit to remember. It's like, oh right, this is like Breath of the Wild, so I kind of had to remember like how that worked. Like I remembered some parts, I had to re-remember some other parts. But one of the things I will give this game is that it does like have a slightly better like tutorial system than the first game did. Admittedly, the first game, part of what its appeal was the fact that it kind of just sort of threw you out in the middle and you had to start swimming, you know? But other than that, I think this might be pretty close to my game of the year so far. It really is that damn good. And part of what I really love is that they've really kind of gone in on world building this time, unlike the sort of vague stuff that a lot of previous Zelda games did. This one, they're actually sort of, you know, this is pretty much like the first Zelda game that acknowledges that there is a Zelda timeline in effect. Like, obviously you had, you know, Ocarina of Time, which kind of talks about that. But this one actually acknowledges that, you know, there's a history here and, you know, there's stuff that's happened in the past that's affecting the future and all this. And as I have been told, apparently there is a time travel aspect that comes in later on. So among other things, I love the fact that, you know, this is a, you know, you would think like, you know, oh, this is, you know, it's basically just the same as, you know, Hyrule from Breath of the Wild, but things have advanced to a point now that it seems like a completely different place. Like, you know, they've, like, you really do get the sense that this is a place that was on the brink, but is now bouncing back and starting to rebuild. You know, because you'll see, like, various, like, members of, like, the various tribes, like, you'll see, like, settlements around, and, like, the Gerudo in particular, you'll see some of their settlements, like, outside of the desert show up. You know, all of them are sort of, they're starting to, like, build new infrastructure and everything, and it feels like they're actually, like, progressing. And part of that is the fact that because of people like the Sheikah, they've basically, they're kind of advancing in a technological way, though at a very slow pace. And speaking of the Sheikah stuff, all the old, like, you know, tech and stuff, that is, they've really, we know from, like, the trailer that they really kind of went in on that aspect of the game, and I've only really scratched the surface of it, and yet it's amazing just the amount of stuff you can create simply with the things that are given to you. You know, I was in one of the shrines where you had to, like, attach a, like, a steering wheel and one of the, like, rotary fans to a sled, and I got to, like, use it to, like, go across, like, a sea of sand and everything. And that was just so cool. You know, the fact that you've got all this stuff that you can use, these fans and these, like things that are basically rockets for all intents and purposes. You know, hot air balloons. And, like, one of the first things that you end up coming across, like, one of the first big things is, a glider. And I don't mean like the paraglider you use, but literally like a paper glider that's made to look like a bird when you're up there on the islands up in the top and you're making your way to the area where you can finally make yourself back down to land. And you attach like a fan to it and it blows you out. And, you know, you don't even have to worry if it runs out of battery power because it'll just still glide to your destination. It's just, and really, like I said, I've only scratched the surface, and yet there are so many ways I can see that you can go about this game. There really is no wrong way to play Tears of the Kingdom. You've got a bunch of options available to you, and all it takes is you being able to figure out what to do with them. As far as like temples, the only temple I've unlocked so far is the Wind Temple, but I haven't actually like gone through it yet because I still need to get the rest of the, you know, the warmer costume to put on so that, you know, I won't freeze to death up there. Yeah, it's a great game. How many of the temples have you gone through so far?
None.
You haven't done any of the temples yet? You said you're just trying to do the towers, right?
Yeah, I don't think I've seen any of the temples.
Okay. Yeah, I've done the Wind Temple. Well, I mean, I've gotten to it. You go to it through Rito Village, but yeah. It's amazing the amount of things you can do in that game. And just the number of tools that they give you. I will admit, though, the one thing about it that's kind of off-putting is, you know, in Breath of the Wild, it kind of took you a while to sort of, you know, gain all of these abilities and stuff. Because you had to sort of work for it. Whereas in Tears of the Kingdom, they give you a bunch of these powers, like, right off the bat. And it can be kind of hard to remember. It's like, oh, yeah, I have this option. Because I kept wanting to, like, climb up places and then forgetting, like, oh, I can do that thing where I can, like, just jump up through, like, the top of a place and, like, climb up through it, you know, using my power. But, you know, still, a lot of fun. Great game. Amazing game. Really good. And like I said, I've only scratched the surface. There's still a bunch to work with, but... So let's see, what else? Reading, doing that as usual. I've been reading Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, which, do you know who Cormac McCarthy is?
Directly, I've probably heard of his work.
He wrote The Road, he wrote No Country for Old Men, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is one of his earlier books, and it's more or less considered to be the book that kind of made him famous. It's essentially a Western, but it's a Western. It does to the Western what, like, Apocalypse Now does to the war movie. It is incredibly violent and dark and nihilistic and even surreal in most places. Mostly, it's about this guy. He literally has no name. He's just called the Kid. And literally, like, the first part of the book is him basically cutting off all ties with whatever identity he had before he became the Kid, as they say. And he ends up he goes through a bunch of stuff first. Like, the main plot is he gets... caught up with this group called the Glanton Gang, which were an actual thing. They were the Glanton Gang, like, historically, they were a group of scalp hunters originally from Arkansas who made their way to the Texas-Mexico border. And they would basically go and through the borderlands and they would basically massacre natives, scalp them, and then... they would take the scalps to the U.S., the U.S. Government outposts, and, you know, they get paid for them because, you know, this was like after the Mexican-American War and there was still, you know, shit going down there. But before that happens, he basically has to go through what's kind of like sort of like a deconstruction of like the boy going out to seek his fortune in the West, wherein just a bunch of awful shit happens to him. He goes to like a tent revival where the people find out that the preacher is apparently this con artist who like did a bunch of like rape and robberies, and so they basically lynch him. And then he goes out and he gets like robbed by a bunch of bandits, and he has to seek up some, you know, shelter with this weird hermit out in the desert. And then he gets captured by banditos, and eventually he just sort of happens to the Glanton gang, and they just decide to take him in. And one of the guys in this gang is a guy named Judge Holton, who, weirdly enough, is based on like a historical figure, but the one that is in the book is like very just not historical at all. He's this very fat, bald, hairless albino guy who might very well be the devil. Like the book never comes out and says it, but like there's a bunch of things that seem to imply that this guy might be like literally Satan. And basically he's with the Glanton gang, and he's like one of their most infamous hatchet men. And you know, he's a polyglot. He can speak a bunch of languages. He can play a bunch of instruments, and he's very knowledgeable of the arts and science and history. Remember how I told you earlier that, you know, the people who found out that preacher was a raper and robber who was out wanted by a bunch of states, and they lynched him? Yeah, it turns out none of it's true. Judge Holden was the people who told him. He made it up on the spot and gladly admits it. And yeah, he literally says war is God. And then of course there's John Glanton himself, the head of the Glanton gang, and he's just exactly what you would think. He is a horribly sadistic, awful human being and racist who is going out and killing Indians because he just wants to. It is a dark book, and it's not difficult to read physically. Like, Cormac McCarthy has his very specific style of writing that tends to somewhat change book to book, but generally he doesn't do things like he doesn't use dialogue markers. So, you know, the book just kind of tells you that, you know, this person is saying this and this is a conversation, but you're never like really like it never like clearly delineates when the dialogue starts or where it ends. It's just sort of implied through the text. And yet, weirdly enough, it's very easy to read. Like, I got through the first 100 pages in like about an hour and a half, and the book's only about 337 pages long. But it is, somebody once compared it to like Dante's Inferno mixed with Moby Dick and Lonesome Dove, and that's pretty good descriptor, because this book basically strips every last bit of romanticism of the Western genre and just drenches it in blood. And it can be very unpleasant at times, but God, is it so good. It's a great book. And let's see, what else? Well, really, last thing other than that is, well, as I have to talk about many times on the show, and as I've mentioned many times on this show and you know, on Day Zero, I live in a part of Macon that doesn't have garbage service, so every so often I have to take my dad's truck and load up the garbage cans and the bags and stuff and take them physically to the dump myself and empty them by hand. Well, my dad's got a new-ish truck that we started driving, and he's been doing work on it because it's clearly like an older truck he bought it like at a cheaper price because it was kind of a wrecker and he wanted to refurbish it. So one of the things that I discovered this week is that he's been sort of doing work on trying to get the turn signals to start working again, because when he bought it, the turn signals were shot, and he basically had to redo it. But the thing is, you know, those wires that, you know, connect the turn signals and the horn, they're actually kind of close together. And turns out there's a short in the wiring. So every time you make a sharp turn with the truck, the horn starts blowing. And so every time, you know, fortunately, I had to make when I'm driving that truck to the dump, but every time I had to make a turn, yeah, just it's annoying. But yeah, so that happened. So you want to add anything else before we move on?
Nope.
Alrighty then. Well, with that out of the way, it is now time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Brandon's Random Factoid. Now, Chris, now if Teresa were here, I would ask her this, but she would probably have an easier time of it. Chris, when you're craving pizza, do you have like a favorite local place that you like to go to? Or is there like a good, you know, smallerish local chain or whatever that you like to go to that's pretty good?
Really?
Not really?
No.
I mean, I know it's Ohio, but.
I mean, we got local chains. I don't necessarily go out for pizza all that much, so whenever I'm just craving it, it's just like, I'll get whatever. It doesn't really matter. That's outside of like one chain I hate.
Yeah.
That my parents would always get Krause's here.
Ugh.
It's beloved by old people and young people hate it.
Yeah. What about like the larger chains, like, you know, Pizza Hut or Domino's or, you know, Papa John's? What about one of those places?
I'd be more likely to go to like Pizza Hut or Domino's.
Especially when we were younger. Because Pizza Hut used to be awesome. You know, you used to be able to get free pizza if you read a book. You know, it was cool. Yeah.
Going in was fun.
Yeah, because they had like an arcade and everything. It was cool.
Yeah.
Now, I want to ask you a question. Do you know what the largest pizza chain is in the United States? And I'm going to give you a hint. It's not what you think it is. No, no cheating. Don't go looking up on Google. That would be cheating.
No, I'll go with Papa John's.
Nope. Not even close. You want to know what the largest pizza chain in the United States is? It's going to shock you out crazy because you're like, how is that even possible?
Chuck E. Cheese?
Nope.
Something like that?
Mm-mm. I'll tell you. And it's going to blow your hair back. But once I explain it to you, you're going to be like, oh, that's how they do it. Are you ready? The largest pizza chain in the United States is Hunt Brothers Pizza. Now, I know you're thinking, I have never fucking heard of this.
Yeah.
Okay, I will explain. So, when it comes to, like, pizza chains, you'll have, like, the restaurants like Domino's, you know, or Pizza Hut. I would say Papa John's, but Papa John's doesn't really do, like, in-house pizza restaurants. Most of their stuff is like, you know, delivery kiosks or whatever, like in a strip mall or something. That's the one where we go to is, you know, and then you have places like Little Caesars who basically just, you know, get all of their pizzas like pre-made and just, you know, warm them up in the oven so that it's like super cheap, you know, $5 for a large pepperoni, you know.
Yeah.
But then there's the layer, there's the tier that is below that, and that is where the Hunt Brothers come in. The reason the Hunt Brothers pizza chain is so large is because they came up with the idea of creating kiosks in gas stations that sell their pizza. They basically pre-make their pizzas, they send out the ovens, and then they just send the pizza to you, and they sell them out of the gas stations. If you live in the deep south like I do, or you live out in the Midwest, you will see a Hunt Brothers pizza. It will usually be, like, Hunt Brothers is the type of pizza that you get at a place that barely has any restaurants at all. Like, it might have, like, the best it'll have as far as commerce is it might have a Walmart, a Dollar General, and maybe a McDonald's, and that's it. That's where Hunt Brothers comes in. They've been around since like 1991. They were originally out of Nashville. And as of 2021, they've got over 8,000 locations in 30 different states. It also helps that they managed to partner up with the Army and Air Force Exchange Service. So they've got a few of these opened up on U.S. bases in Germany as well. So it has no franchise fees, royalty fees, or advertising fees, and it basically offers marketing support to bring in a profit. And again, because they're usually located in rural areas, that means they're usually one of the very small groups of pizzas that you can get in a general area. I know I used to eat them fairly regularly when I was a little younger, and I would go to my grandmother's because my grandma lives just down road from a gas station that had a Hunt's Brothers in it. So, you know, we could just go there and, you know, if he was like, oh, let's get some pizza. And she's like, all right, we'll get some pizza. We can go to the Hunt Brothers, go down to the gas station. We can get it there. And as far as, like, you know, cash and carry pizza goes, not bad, you know. I mean, it's still pizza. But it's one of those things where it's like, if you've ever had, like, genuinely good pizza, Hunt's Brothers is barely, like, chain-level pizza. You know, and it's okay, but you can kind of understand why it's one of those things that hides in plain sight and most people have never heard of them. And yet, as I said, they are the largest pizza chain in the United States. And that has been yet another installment of Brandon's Random Factoid. All right. So, with that out of the way, it is now time to move on to the show proper. And as always, with the show proper, we start off with our at with the assholes of the week. Or, as we can basically call it this week, the GOP are assholes, and they just want to make things worse for everyone. Because that's literally the entirety of what we've got here this week. Literally, just everything. So, let's start with this story out of North Carolina. The House representatives that are dominated by the GOP in North Carolina overrode the governor's veto of their 12-week abortion ban, thanks to this individual who was an attention-seeking Democrat that switched parties last month. Yeah. This asshole. I remember them.
Yeah, she goes by the name of Trisha Cotham.
Mm-hmm.
Who ran on, you know, pro-abortion, pro-trans, you know, stances, that kind of stuff, LGBTQ rights and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And decided at some point she wasn't getting enough, you know, positive reinforcement from Democrats. So she decided, I'm going to switch to the GOP where they, you know how to support their people right.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave them a 2/3 majority in the House, the state House, because, yeah, they pushed this 12-week abortion ban to their Democratic governor, who vetoed it, mm-hmm. and the Senate voted to override it, mm-hmm. and then the House voted also to override it to put this back into law.
Yeah.
Essentially. And that's really fucking shitty. And now people that voted for her are basically wanting her to
resign.
I don't know about resign, but find some sort of recourse to get her for fraud or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because we need something like that in this country, where if you're running on, a slate of, you know, things you support that you do not follow up in any way. In fact, you swap parties to go against those things.
Mm-hmm.
There should be some sort of recourse on that. Mm. She says here, some call me a hypocrite since I voted for this bill. She said that the bill struck a reasonable balance and presented the middle ground of two extremes,
mm-hmm.
which is like, these are not two extremes. It's one extreme. And one that wants people to have the right to an abortion when and if they need it. And not like, you should never have an abortion in any circumstance kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Shit's bad in North Carolina right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there's shit in Nebraska, which is also getting bad. So the Nebraska GOP originally could not get a trans health care ban passed because apparently there were a group of Republicans who had at least some decency who wouldn't vote for it. So they tacked on an abortion ban just so they could pass it. And somehow that just makes it even worse.
Yeah. They just pulled this really shitty move to add a 12-week abortion ban on top mm-hmm. of restrictions on gender-affirming care for people younger than 19.
Yeah.
And a move that they could get this pushed over the edge.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's at a point where people on both sides seem like they may not be able to work together in the future mm-hmm. for good. Which, yeah, that seems reasonable for when you pull this kind of stunt.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there were at least one Democrat, I'm trying to see if she's named in here, who is basically, Omaha Senator Michaela Kavanaugh, mm-hmm. Who had been, you know, filibustering every single trans bill that showed up, along with a handful of other progressive allies. Slowed the business of passing laws to a crawl by introducing amendment after amendment to every bill that made it to the Senate floor that sent leadership scrambling to prioritize which bills to push through.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of led to this situation where, they had to do this. And because of all this, you had people complaining, especially on the GOP side, like, I got things to do. You know, there's this one video of a lady who's like, oh, I want to go to the my grandson's elementary school graduation, but you guys are filibustering this so much to drag it out, I'm going to miss it. To which, I think it's Michaela Kavanaugh was the one that was speaking to her, was like, you hate my trans son so much that you, or you hate my trans son more than your own family. That's why you're here to make sure this happens. That kind of thing, like really contentious actions there. That's it's a fun whole thing where the GOP is just going to war mm-hmm. in all the states they can pull this shit off. We're kind of having that a little bit here in Ohio where the GOP that runs the state house and Senate passed a law that will change the rules required to pass state amendments that go to public votes mm-hmm. for instead of just a simple majority, 50% plus one,
mm-hmm.
it would change it to at least 60%. So now I have to go and vote against that shit in August to shoot that down. They're doing that because mm-hmm. an amendment for making abortion, legal in the amendments, in our state amendments, is going up in this November.
Mm-hmm.
So they need to get that law into place so that it has a next to no chance of passing
mm-hmm.
at that rate. So that's where we're at in the U.S. In case you're wondering, the state GOP is going to war every place that they can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's just the whole thing, the fact that tacked on just like as an afterthought the abortion ban to it just shows how little they actually take any of this seriously. Like it's just petty is what it is. And yeah but let's see. Okay, so now here's another thing here, a little story. So in the state of Oregon, they had a problem with having like state representatives basically fleeing the state so that they couldn't have like a quorum met so that any particular legislation could be passed. So basically the Democrats got pissed off and was like, you know what, we're going to change the law so that if you end up doing this 10 times and have an unexcused absence, we can basically prevent you from running for re-election. Well, that's now happened to 10 Oregon Republican representatives. They will not be able to run for re-election because they've reached their 10th unexcused absence to block pro-abortion, gun control, and trans health care bills.
Yeah. Yeah, they've been doing this for a bit. But yeah, this was Measure 113, which was voted into law overwhelmingly by voters last year, that disqualified lawmakers from serving their next term if they missed 10 unexcused or had 10 unexcused absences. And these GOP idiots decided to try to essentially block anything from happening in their, I think this is the state Senate. So that meant that, you know, they've been unable to field any of these bills they had in the pipeline. And so they ran themselves off the cliff to their 10th unexcused absence, since they will not be able to run for re-election here in the next election that they have, which is a good idea. Seems like a thing where, unless you have, you know, some ongoing, you know, medical or personal leave kind of thing going on, you should have to show up for, you know, as much as you can. You know, obviously they have, you know, 9 that they can do before they get in any sort of trouble. And they seem to believe that they are going to challenge this up to the state Supreme Court. And that may not work out for them, because they may just continue doing this for the foreseeable future until they get some sort of declaration by the state Supreme Courts. But yeah, they've essentially gotten themselves disqualified for the next election, which is at least a good thing.
Yeah.
Show the people who's serious about representing their constituents.
Yeah. And now we got this bit of bullshit. So the LA Dodgers basically canceled their invitation to a drag nuns group for their Pride Night celebrations due to pressure from Marco Rubio and the Catholic League that had led to other groups pulling out. The group, by the way, is the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, which is a very famous sort of drag repertoire. They've been around for years. They've been an integral part of the gay rights movement since pretty much since it began. And once again, showing that Marco Rubio has no ideas of it. He's just as bad a coat chaser, a tail chaser, as Ted Cruz is. And you don't need to listen to the Catholic League, because they are not serious people.
Yeah. I believe in some people have been posting like other quotes they've had, and they talk about, you know, when minors have been abused through the Catholic Church. He put out statements of like, you know, they were kind of asking for it, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Which is like, all right, that's fucked up. And yeah, Marco Rubio posted a big letter to Rob Manfred, the chairman of the MLB commissioner, and, you know, to LA, to the LA Dodgers themselves and all this. It seemed like this was enough for them to just pull this invitation for the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, which makes no sense. One, Marco Rubio is not a senator for their state.
Yeah.
He's a Florida senator. And seems to have nothing to do there, so he's meddling in the affairs of California. And the, you know, LA's, you know, the Dodgers organization seems to be terrible if they're giving into this kind of shit to show how thin-skinned corporations are now with the supposed backlash that they get from right-wing groups. Because, you know, we had the Bud Light thing, Miller Lite had a thing, though that was an old thing. People just discovered it recently, like this video of them talking about, you know, women that have made beer for centuries kind of thing. People are like getting mad, like, oh, they're going woke. And it's like, this is for Women's History Month. What the fuck are you idiots doing just finding this out now? But yeah, as more and more companies are, you know, as we get closer to Pride Month, that's, you know, a thing that companies do is put out new ads to say like, hey, we're cool with gay people. And you can see how thin some of these are when they are so easy to back out.
Yeah.
which is what the Dodgers have done here. And so as a result, some of the other groups like LA Pride, the ACLU, I believe, pulled out maybe one or two others as well. And it's just like, great job, guys. You've shown that you don't actually care about, you know, your LGBTQ audience. You just care about the visuals of it. And even then, the people that are paying attention now know that you guys are cowards and willing to back down to people that you have no reason to. And so, yeah, I believe one of the figureheads of the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence put out a scathing statement about the stupidity of the Dodgers doing this in response to, you know, Marco Rubio and the Catholic League and all that. So, yeah, great job to the LA Dodgers.
Yeah. And then we got this shit out of Florida, the free state of Florida, which is investigating a teacher that showed the Disney film Strange World to her class. Because they got nothing better to do, I guess.
Well, because it has a gay character in it, and that's illegal in Florida now, I guess. That they have to harass this woman and the school and all that. But yeah, she teaches fifth grade in Hernando County School District. Jenna Barbie says a student's mother lodged a complaint with education officials after she showed the film Strange World in her classroom. She said the movie focused on humans' relationships to the environment, which was why she chose to show it to her class after a section on ecosystems, plants, and animals. Said a subplot about a boy having a crush on another boy never crossed her mind before screening the film. Which is, yeah, it's a Disney movie. It's nothing, you know, insidious going on. But if you're in Florida, it is insidious because, you know, I don't know. That's the woke indoctrination thing that they believe happens, which is, no, they're just teaching kids to not be hateful bigots as best they can. And so, yeah, that's a whole thing.
And we got the last of the week, which everybody has probably found out now, George Santos recently indicted on a bunch of counts, including what was it? It was like I don't think it was electoral fraud, but it was like I think it was campaign finance fraud and a bunch
money
of
laundering
other,
and
yeah, money laundering,
lying to Congress,
and a bunch of other things. Of course, when he came out of the courthouse, he was like, "No, this is all set up. No, we know he did all this shit." And this is 100% like grounds for expulsion.
Yeah.
Like even his own constituents want him out. The House GOP blocked the resolution to expel George Santos from Congress.
Yeah, basically voted for a resolution that would send the matter to the House Ethics Committee, which was already doing that. So just basically punting it away from, you know, any real consequences, and was completely, you know, down party lines, 221 to 204. All the Republicans voted for this resolution, and all the Democrats voted against it. It's just goes to show you that the GOP will take anybody they can on their side, criminals, abusers, all that kind of stuff.
But then we go in and we find out we do Heroes of the Week, and one of them is Penguin Random House, one of the major publishers in the United States, and five authors. I'm not sure if they're all related to Penguin Random House, but it might be, are suing a Florida school board over its book bans.
The lawsuit alleges the school officials acted in defiance of existing policies and a review board's recommendations when they removed books, and that the removals have disproportionately affected books that address racism and LGBTQ relationships. Leading the suit is the writers' advocacy group Pen America and Penguin Random House, the largest publisher in the U.S. Joining the suit are five authors whose books have been challenged and two parents of students currently attending an elementary school in the district, which includes the city of Pensacola as Escambia County. The plaintiffs say the lawsuit is the first of its kind in addressing a new nationwide wave of conservative-led efforts to ban books from schools and libraries that activists say are sexually explicit or otherwise inappropriate for young readers. And yeah, last year, one of their teachers challenged 116 books available in school district libraries or what she characterized as explicit sexual content, graphic language, themes, vulgarity, and political pushes.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure that teacher is a very fun person to work with.
Mm-hmm.
Others filed similar challenges, bringing the total number of currently challenged books to 197. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the school board ordered 10 books to remove from some school libraries, including the frequently challenged book novels The Perks of Being a Wallflower by Stephen Chbosky and The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison.
Yeah.
150 of the remaining challenged books are on restricted access until a review can be completed.
Yeah.
That must mean they actually have somebody read those books.
Mm-hmm.
If it's taken them so long. So,
yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. So this shit is not going unchallenged. Good. And our other hero of the week is Martha Stewart, who became the oldest cover model for a Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue.
Yeah. She is 81. And sort of part of the suite of people they had on the cover this year. I think there's a trans woman on there, which, you know, angers a lot of people until you point out they've been doing this for the past couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you're getting angry over nothing. And, yeah, I think one was Megan Fox, and I forget what the other one is, an athlete, I believe. So, yeah. Cool that they're doing this. You can see definitely some of the pictures, and she's definitely trying something different. I don't think she's ever been a sort of model person before, outside of, like, you know, cooking and home making kind of books or magazines, that kind of stuff. So there you go, something cool.
Mhm. And yeah, so now. That was the end of the show proper. Now we go to the proper show proper, and we go to our first major story of the night, which is that Erdogan, the current president of Turkey, is heading to a runoff election after he failed to reach at least 50% of the votes.
Yeah.
He
got 49.4%, so got pretty close.
Yeah, compared to his Kemal, the guy who's his opponent in this race and arguably the person who should take over as president of Turkey, but
yeah,
that's up to the people and, you know, whether or not they don't do too much election fixing, because unfortunately that does happen in Turkey. But so we'll see. But yeah, go on.
No, that's it. Basically, the other guy is sort of the candidate put by a coalition of six other parties.
Yeah, of varying political origins, who basically just want Erdogan to leave.
Yeah.
The reason people are worried about this is because if Erdogan does end up losing by a small margin, it's possible that he'll refuse to leave, which means that there might be another military coup coming. Which is something that has happened on and off in the past in Turkey, because the military sort of sees itself as like the guardian of Ataturk's principles. But the thing is, Erdogan kind of knows that, so he's been spending a good part of his tenure as president of Turkey to try and put his own sort of sycophants into the army proper, so that if there is another attempt at a coup, that it'll basically just give him dictatorial power. Remember, they tried to have a coup a couple of years ago, and it failed.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but we'll see. Okay, next up, The IRS is working on its own tax filing system, and it is really pissing off the various tax company and tax software makers.
Yeah. This is a system that will let taxpayers send electronic returns directly to the government for free, sidestepping, you know, the commercial options from like TurboTax and all these other ones. They're planning a pilot test of the program next year. As we've said before, most of the countries already offer some sort of version of this, and some even going so far as where they just send you the like itemized bill and it's like, does this check out? If so, here's, you know, what you owe or what you're going to get back, kind of thing. They talked to, Rick Heinemann, a spokesman for Intuit, the company behind TurboTax, saying a direct-to-IRS e-file system is wholly redundant and is nothing more than a solution in search of a problem. That solution will unnecessarily cost taxpayers billions of dollars and especially harm the most vulnerable Americans.
Bullshit.
I don't know how it costs taxpayers billions of dollars to send their return in directly to the government for free.
Yeah. There's a bunch of states that already do this shit, by the way.
Yeah, it's like, this is only an issue costing people billions of dollars that own these companies.
Yeah. It's also pretty much only an issue in America.
Yeah.
Most other countries figured this out a long time ago.
Yeah, unfortunately, the GOP and these tax companies, work together to get the IRS's ability to do this stuff, greatly hampered.
Yeah,
about like 20 years ago.
Which goes to show you that they don't really give a shit about taxes anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a cynical political move on their part. But
2% of taxpayers use the free filing options that are currently available.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, that's because, these companies make that harder to find and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They even show, here's the main site you go to, and it's like, oh, this looks like it's going to be free, but as soon as you start doing anything, it's like, oh, you need this version that costs, this much.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of stuff. And they'll put the actual full free thing on a different website because, that makes it harder to find.
Yeah. Let's see. Next up. House Representative Cori Bush has introduced new legislation calling for $14 trillion in reparations.
Yeah. I don't expect this to go anywhere, really.
Yeah, but I don't think even he expects it to go anywhere.
Or she.
Or she, but...
Yeah, it's at least a good thought to put it out there and sort of get the discussion going, but obviously the GOP is not going to be anywhere for anything like this.
Mm-hmm.
Because black people aren't already rich, so why would they get more money?
Mm.
It's only for the billionaires and the corporations to get extra money back.
Mm.
That's the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
Yeah. And and now for another story in the ongoing saga between the Walt Disney Corporation and Governor Ron DeSantis. Disney has canceled plans for a $1 billion Florida campus while also shutting down its extremely expensive Star Wars hotel. I don't think that last one is related, but it's also happening.
Yeah, it's not really. They canceled this nearly $1 billion office complex in Florida that would also have moved more than 2,000 jobs to the state. But, the Disney Parks chairman told employees in an email Thursday that the company has decided not to move forward with the massive office complex in Orlando because of new leadership and changing business conditions. And, comes a week after Bob Iger said an ongoing dispute with Ron DeSantis raised questions about the company's continued investment in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes a lot of sense for them. Stop... massive investment in Florida as much as they can. This is a big war that Ron DeSantis has been raising for the past year or so, and Disney has put out their biggest move yet.
Mm-hmm.
which is basically, how do you like not getting $1 billion here in new construction and business here?
Yeah.
And yeah, the hotel, I don't know exactly what this is all about, but it's last bookings for September 28th. And yeah, September 28th to the 30th, new bookings are being paused until May 26th to first accommodate those who made reservations after September.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this is a hotel that is incredibly expensive. Two-night packages started about $4,800 for two people, go up to about $5,300 for two adults and one child, and about $6,000 for three adults and one child.
Mm.
Prices include lodging, meals, and admission to Hollywood Studios. Upon arriving, guests enter a launch pod to board the Halcyon Star Cruiser, stay in a room with a space view, and are able to interact with the franchise's characters throughout the ship.
Mm.
So it's a neat idea for a thing, but it seems way over designed, and, you know, way overly expensive, even though the Disney park stuff has gotten much more expensive over the last like 10 to 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Probably from when, you know, we would have gone as kids.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, their popularity shot way up and, you know, they can make a lot more money off of people now. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's a disappointment for Star Wars fans, unfortunately. Maybe they'll figure out a better way to do this kind of stuff in the future, but
yeah,
it seems like maybe a bit too ambitious and expensive of a thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Next up. So, you know, we've been talking about for the past couple of years that right now the momentum is on the side of labor as it comes to labor organizing and unions, and new unions are being founded pretty much every week. And this week, we got a brand new one out of Los Angeles, where the dancers at a topless bar unanimously voted to unionize to become the only one of its type in the United States.
Yeah. The topless dive bar in L.A. unanimously voted to unionize 17-0. Held on Zoom by the National Labor Relations Board on Thursday means the strippers will join the Actors Equity Association,
mm-hmm.
the union that represents more than 51,000 actors and stage managers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, after months of employer opposition to this union drive, lawyers representing the owners of the Star Garden topless dive bar withdrew all election challenges and agreed to recognize the union. So that's cool.
Mm-hmm.
The news comes after a 15-month battle between the North Hollywood Club and the group of dancers who are seeking higher compensation, safer working conditions, including better security to protect them from belligerent patrons.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there you go. Some good news.
Mm-hmm. So that's happening. That's some good shit. And next up, Google. Google will be deleting old accounts that haven't lost in the past 24 months. Yeah, they're kind of cleaning out cash, I guess.
Yeah, the last 24 months, you should be trying to log into any Google accounts you care about. There's definitely a part of this that people are concerned about, which was YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
That would, you know, punish, you know, accounts of people that passed away or people who don't, you know, upload to YouTube anymore, that kind of stuff. Because not everybody uses, like, their main Gmail account for YouTube. A lot of people set up, you know, secondary accounts that they use for that stuff. But, yeah, they have apparently updated, at least recently after the initial announcement of this new policy change, that, yeah, accounts with YouTube videos will not be in the plan to be deleted. So that is good news there. But they also say that they are not like putting these new addresses out for people to use
mm-hmm.
anytime soon. So that's maybe a little disappointing for people that have potential to upgrade to better names. They had to take names they didn't want to really take, but You know, this just seems like more tech people deciding we don't want to have to host all this data that we've taken on. You know, Twitter's been doing that with old accounts, which is, you know, bad for the people. They don't even have anything to, like, grandfather accounts that, you know, were manned by somebody that passed away, that kind of stuff that I think, like, Facebook has to put the accounts of these kind of people into a different status so that people know, like, what's going on there. So, but yeah, this is just more big tech deciding they don't want to host old data.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah. And let's see, what else? Yeah, now we got some science news here. Scientists have done a full-size digital deep-sea scan of the Titanic shipwreck. So you can actually get, like, a good idea of what the actual wreck looks like. Up to this point, they've only really been able to kind of map it out. Like, they have a pretty good idea of what, like, the whole thing looks like. But now we can actually, like, see for real, like, entirely what it looks like. As you can imagine, it's been underwater for over 100 years now, and it is decaying spectacularly. And yet, somehow, a lot of it is still very much intact, which is surprising.
Yeah. And it's kind of wild for perspective. It's been underwater for 111 years at this point.
Yeah.
We only found it where it's been sitting at about less than 40 years ago.
Yeah, and I think it was like around 1980?
Yeah, 85.
85, when they finally found it. Like, they did have kind of like a general idea of where it was, because, you know, they kept a lot of those places, you know, they kept in, you know, sort of general of idea of where these things were going. But, you know, it's the middle of the Atlantic, you know.
It's about 400 nautical miles off the coast of Newfoundland, Canada.
Yep.
I was like, man, it got pretty close to the end. But, yeah, they used this technology developed by Magellan Limited. Scientists managed to map the Titanic in its entirety from its bow to stern sections, which broke apart after sinking, to its 3-by-5-mile debris field. It's an exact digital twin of the wreck. What we've created is a highly accurate photorealistic 3D model of the wreck. Previously, footage has only allowed you to see one small area of the wreck at a time. This model will allow people to zoom out and look to the entire thing for the first time. And yeah, so the first time we've had this, a lot of it's been just footage or pictures or whatever, trying to piece it together. But this is sort of a full scan to get a really good look at this. And it's, generated an unprecedented 16 terabytes of data and more than 715,000 still images and 4K video footage.
Only thing is, I don't see the stern. Like, remember, they did say the stern broke off. I'm pretty sure it's kind of a back a ways. If it's still around.
Yeah, they do have it. This one shot's just a portion of it. Because it's like a 3-by-5-mile debris field.
Yeah. But yeah, that is neat. And I know somewhere James Cameron has a massive erection while sitting on his pile of money. But moving on from there. Now we got another bit of labor news. SAG-AFTRA, that's the Screen Actors Guild. And what's the AFTRA part? I forgot what the AFTRA part is.
I'm not sure. I forget.
Well, it doesn't matter. Anyway, all you need to know is they're calling for a strike authorization vote ahead of its June 7 negotiation with studios. And if you're wondering why they're doing that, it's basically for leverage. They did this back in 2018 before they went into negotiations, just so that they were like telling the studio bosses, look, we can go on strike at any moment, and we've got, you know, the unions go ahead to do it if you don't meet our demands. So,
yeah. Yeah, American Federation of Television and Radio Artists.
There we go.
But yeah, they are essentially just trying to get the the temperature of the room for willingness to strike if the the offerings in this negotiation aren't to their liking, kind of thing. So, but they're also piggybacking off the current writer's strike.
Yeah.
Which is not going well for the studios. They have had to, you know, admit how much damage it's doing to them.
Yeah.
For the studios. And, you know, people thought some of the projects that were going on that, you know, there might have been some scab work going on. Because I think, what is it? Andor, Star Wars Andor, the series was working on, you know, season two. And people are like, well, what about the, you know, the showrunner? What's he doing still working on this? And he's like, no, I left like right before the strike started. Basically, Disney had made it seem like that was a whole thing there where. No, they're just kind of lying about this, who's working on these things, about that. But yeah, SAG-AFTRA is sort of the actors' guild that, you know, is going to probably help the writers' guild get their deal done and joining them, because that's going to be essentially it for trying to get anything done if they can't get it done by June 7th. Or get the deals done by, you know, June 7th when they start working on that. But yeah, their current contract expires June 30th, so we'll see how that goes. And yeah, right after this is the Directors Guild would be the next one to be up for potential strike if the deals are not in their favor. So
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah. And now we got a couple of stories from Disney and HBO Max, technically. Disney is pulling a bunch of movies and series from Disney Plus and Hulu. What else is new?
Yeah, this is disappointing because HBO and, you know, Warner Brothers Discovery's been doing this a bunch, and Disney's had a history of this as far as physical releases.
Yeah.
But their, you know, digital releases have not experienced much of the vault, as it was called then. But now it seems like they are doing that here. Pulling a bunch of stuff up to, or about 50 titles, including Willow, the movie, and the new series that just released last year.
Yeah.
Dollface, Mysterious Benedict Society. The Pentatonix concert thing they have on there. The Mighty Ducks show that just ended. A bunch of stuff on here. It's kind of staggering. It's not like any huge things, but there is The World According to Jeff Goldblum, which was sort of the documentary series that like launched with Disney Plus. That's also on there. It's like, wow, what's going on here that's causing this? And Hulu is losing some stuff as well. Yeah, Dollface is there. Nothing that sticks out as like a huge thing, but you know, that's still an annoying thing, as Disney seems to be also looking to acquire the full control of Hulu. That they're not going to eat whatever it costs to keep these things on there. But I'm guessing this is part of the infinite growth goals of these companies.
Yep.
Because you're not going to make as much money if you have this stuff on there. So why keep it on there and maybe shop it out to somewhere else that will pay for it, and then that's extra money for you.
Yep.
And it's like, what's the point of these services if they're not archiving your, you know, back catalog of stuff?
But, yeah. And speaking of, you know, back catalog, Avatar The Way of Water is coming to Disney Plus and Max on June 7th. So now you can see the movie that made all the money everybody freaking talked about.
Yeah, and didn't surpass the original, did it?
I mean, it still made over $1 billion.
Yeah, but I think people were expecting it to beat the original, and I don't think it did. I think it probably got close, but
no.
Maybe I'll watch that and the original movie now.
Mm-hmm.
They're not trying to pull shenanigans to put Avatar back in theaters and all that shit.
Yeah, but yeah. So that happened. That's happening. We also heard that What We Do in the Shadows Season 5 debuts July 13th.
Yep, great news.
Mm-hmm.
As they get to do more of the weird shit that they've been doing in there, so that's cool. Mm-hmm. Season 4 was very weird, where one character, let's say, goes in a cycle of death and rebirth.
Yep.
And it's a very weird thing that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Because they try to use CG to make it look better than it could, and doesn't really work
mm-hmm.
for the budget that this show has.
Yeah.
I think I've been seeing people talk about the de-aging stuff for Harrison Ford in the new Indiana Jones, and being like, we need to just stop this until it actually gets good.
Mm-hmm.
Because it just looks like shit in every single movie they try it in.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Hey, excited for more of this.
Mm-hmm. We also found out that the Futurama revival will be debuting on Hulu July 24th.
Yeah, there's a little teaser video if you want to see it. It looks like Futurama. They're not changing anything about it.
Yeah.
It's just they're considering this the 8th season.
Mm-hmm.
So they're actually just continuing on from where it left off. And maybe that'll be something I do here is rewatch Futurama, because I've seen the first 4 seasons a ton. It's some of the best animated shows on TV ever.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of the concentrated quality of like the first, you know, 9 or 10 seasons of The Simpsons, but starting at, you know, a 10 out of 10 right away.
Mm-hmm.
For that. But yeah, that'll be July 24th on Hulu. They'll drop episodes weekly on Mondays. I guess they're technically considering this season 8, but also some people call it season 11. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really pay attention when they started doing more stuff on Comedy Central.
Mm.
Oh, yeah, they did the direct-to-video movies that they re-edited into a season.
Mm-hmm.
That whole weird thing. So, yeah, this show's weird at a certain point.
Yeah.
But there you go. Everybody's back. They're properly paying them to get back. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. And here we go. We got, well, no, not yet. We still got some other stuff to talk about before we get trailers. But we do have this one thing from Disney Plus, another thing, really. Loki Season 2 is coming out October 6th, and the Echo series debuts November 29th.
Yeah. Yeah, they're doing more of Loki. It'll be out October 6th.
Mm-hmm.
Continuing on the very popular first season with that character, so that's cool.
Mm.
Echo's going to be interesting. Apparently they're going to just release all the episodes at once on November 29th, so
mm-hmm.
people are assuming that means it's terrible. But I assume it just means it's not. Probably not something that's going to keep people compelled on a weekly basis.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's just better to put it out and let people watch it
mm-hmm.
and see how it all ties into whatever else they're working on. So
mm-hmm.
that's sort of a spinoff of Hawkeye, one of the main people that gets introduced there. So there you go.
Mm-hmm. And then we've got Conan O'Brien. He's got a new travel series called Conan O'Brien Must Go. It's been ordered by Max, so we'll be seeing that sometime soon.
Yeah, since he's, you know, ended his TBS show, there's a whole thing that he had to deal with HBO to do some sort of series there, and that's still not really happened, but they have ordered this 4-episode international travel series called Conan O'Brien Must Go.
Mm-hmm.
That is sort of a spinoff of his podcast.
Mm.
So he has a podcast called Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, where he interviews various, you know, comedian friends and actors, and has done Obama and Michelle Obama a couple of times there, and Hillary Clinton and some other people like that. But he has like another version of the show that also comes out once a week called Conan O'Brien Needs a Fan. mm-hmm. where he chats with a listener or two every week that's, you know, calling from around the globe. I believe they fill out some sort of thing on the website to get considered for it. And it seems like this is him going to, you know, the places that these people are from to visit them and see like their homelands and all that and learn more about where they're from.
Mm-hmm.
Has that sort of been one of the things that people really liked about his show over the years? Is that mm-hmm. he would occasionally do remotes from, you know, other places, oftentimes places where he could just fuck around, but he really enjoyed doing you know, remotes at, I think, Cuba mm-hmm. and Haiti and some of these other places and seeing, you know, a lot of what's really going on there versus, you know, what the news makes out to be in those places. So
mm-hmm.
this seems like a thing that he's doing to at least start working on some of that HBO Max stuff. But yeah, no idea if he's still going to be doing the weekly series, but that was supposed to come out like last year at some point. Or that's when the deal was supposed to have it out by, but I imagine the pandemic sort of thrown that, into the trash, those plans. So, but there you go. That seems like it's going to be pretty cool. I believe he has a Netflix series that is all that kind of stuff, travelogue stuff. So there you go.
Mm-hmm. And all right, now we're getting to the tech trailer. So first we got a teaser trailer for film, new Scorsese film called Killers of the Flower Moon. It's based on a true crime book about the serial murder of members of the Osage Nation in Oklahoma in the 1920s, because people found out they had a bunch of oil underneath their land.
Yep.
And there is kind of a half twist to it, supposedly, but it's kind of what you expect.
Yeah. But yeah, he has some of his regulars, like Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro in this.
Mm-hmm.
But has some other big names, Lily Gladstone, Jesse Plemons, Tanto Cardinal, Cara mm-hmm. Jade Myers, Janae Collins, and Jillian Dion.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this is a partnership with Apple Studios and Paramount, I believe. Mm-hmm. But I believe it's still coming out in theaters October 6th.
Yeah.
It just might be afterwards coming to Apple and Paramount Plus, maybe. I don't know. I don't know what the deal is on that, but mm-hmm. there you go.
Yeah. By the way, it's pronounced Osage, by the way. Just I screwed it up. But yeah. But yeah. Then we got a teaser trailer for the film adaptation of Five Nights at Freddy's. And definitely looks like Five Nights at Freddy's.
Yeah. Yeah. Features Josh Hutcherson as the mm-hmm. the new security guard that gets hired.
Mm-hmm.
Which people would know him from the Hunger Games movies.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I saw this trailer at the front of Fast X. That was like one of the trailers that showed up before that started. And so yeah, that looks neat. Mm-hmm. I don't know that I'll watch it because it seems pretty faithful to the general plot of those early games.
Mm-hmm.
Of just the Freddy and his buddies, you know, coming to life, and they basically treat you as like, oh, you're out of your suit. How did yes. that happen? And they force you into a suit and kill you in the process.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
there you go.
Yeah.
That'll be in theaters and streaming on Peacock October 27th.
Right. And then we got a teaser trailer. Definitely interested in seeing The Creator, which is essentially about like, it takes sort of a well-trodden sort of sci-fi concept and gives it a good degree of weight to it, I think.
Yeah. This is from the director of Rogue One.
Mm-hmm.
The Star Wars movie. Seems neat.
Yeah.
And also it's original. It's not based on a book or, you know, some other property or anything like that. So that's definitely a noteworthy thing.
Yeah, it's a plus.
Yeah. But yeah, seems to be about there being these like sentient robots, humans that humans are going to war with them, and this dude seems to be concerned about that and tries to help out the sentient, you know, robot humans because they're, you know, they're dealing with feelings and all that kind of stuff that humans do, and doesn't like seeing them being killed off like this. So that's the whole thing. That'll be out September 29th. So there you go.
Yeah. And then we got an official trailer for Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning. Yes, Tom Cruise is coming back.
Yeah, he's, what, 60 at this point?
Yep.
And then the big stunt they have for this is that he drives a BMX bike off of a cliff, and I think he goes into like a squirrel suit of sorts to glide out of it at some point. So that's the whole thing that he did there. Plus probably other things, but yeah, that'll be, this is a part one. So this might be one of the last of these, I guess. But this will be out July 12th for this part of it.
Yeah. And then we got an official trailer for Netflix's Extraction 2.
Yeah, this looks really, really good. Follow up to the first Extraction, sort of a fairly straightforward sort of, PMC action movie of sorts, Chris Hemsworth in that. But yeah, manages to survive the events of the end of that movie to get into a new situation here. And sort of the big part of this is that there's like a lengthy, like 20 minute one shot sequence in this movie. So they show off a little bit of that. But yeah, looking forward to seeing more of this. This is the one that the Russo brothers are producing. And one of them wrote the movie, so that's cool. It'll be on Netflix June 16th.
Yeah. And last but not least, we got a teaser trailer for Netflix's Nimona, which is apparently one of those things that's been like, it's a project that's been in the works for like a long time.
Yeah, it's based on a Tumblr comic series.
Yep.
Which is a weird thing, but yeah, that'll be, I guess, a film. It'll be on Netflix June 30th, animated, you know, CG film. So looks neat. Seems to be playing around with the comic book or the comic kind of thing, as there's like clashing art styles and such, at least in this teaser. Who knows if that'll be in the actual movie itself, but that looks neat. That'll be out June 30th.
But, yeah, so that, I believe, has a show. Yep, we got ourselves a show, folks. So I would like to remind all of our listeners, if you got a question, comment, or something you want us to be on the air, you can get in contact with us at letsweekenders@gmail.com. That's letsweekenders@gmail.com. We got link free in the show notes. Also, on top of Apple Podcasts, you can catch our little bit of unscripted shenanigans at Google archive.org, RSS, pretty much any kind of podcast aggregator. If we're not on there, just wait a few minutes. We'll be on there forthwith as soon as we learn of its existence. But with that, we're going to go ahead and shut things down here for tonight, wind up everything. If you liked what you heard, please do not hesitate to tell your friends, your family, minor acquaintances, mortal enemies, and everyone in between to let you know that we exist, because we are desperate for your attention. But yeah, check us out next week. Hopefully we'll have some better news to talk about and maybe a larger crowd. But until then, we'll see y'all next week. Good night, everyone.